Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The late J. William Fulbright was a Democratic U.S. Senator from Arkansas from 1945 to 1974. He is perhaps best known for his early opposition to the Vietnam War in the 1966 book The Arrogance of Power and the hearings he conducted as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. A fledgling politician and fellow Arkansan named Bill Clinton cited him as a mentor. But perhaps Fulbright's most enduring legacy is the Fulbright Program, an international education exchange under the auspices of the U.S. State Department. Our own Dr. Sean Foley, assistant professor of history, recently became a recipient of a Fulbright Award that will take him to Malaysia. Sean is here with us in the studio, and we'll talk to him about his upcoming trip that will take him abroad for 10 months beginning in September. But first, via telephone from Washington, D.C., to talk more about the Fulbright program is Marion Craven, Managing Director for Academic Programs at the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs of the U.S. Department of State. Welcome, Marion. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you very much, Jenna. I'm really happy to have this opportunity to speak with you about the Fulbright Exchange.
Tell us a little bit about what makes this program so special. Whenever someone at an academic institution of higher learning receives a Fulbright Fellowship or any sort of a Fulbright Award, ears immediately perk up and eyebrows immediately perk up because it is known far and wide as sort of the gold standard.
Yes, that's right. It's really a program that exemplifies academic excellence, but even more than that, it's a program that promotes mutual understanding between the people of the United States and people of other countries. So it's a way in which American scholars and students can contribute to better relationships around the world while also pursuing their own research and teaching and professional interests.
The Fulbright program is actually divided into many, many different facets, and I don't think we have time to examine each and every one of them, but in general terms, just go over some of the different ways in which the Fulbright money manifests itself.
Yes, the scholar program is the program that Dr. Foley is participating in. That is for faculty and research scholars, often teaching at U.S. universities, and we have foreign scholars coming to the U.S. as well as American scholars going overseas. The student program is for American college graduates to go overseas. They can do research. They can also serve as Fulbright English teaching assistants. We also bring a lot of foreign students to the U.S. On the Fulbright program for graduate study and to assist with foreign language teaching programs. We conduct teacher exchanges under the Fulbright program for primary and secondary school teachers, and we also support Humphrey Fellowships under the auspices of Fulbright, which is a program for mid-career professionals from countries in the developing world to come to the U.S. for a year of professional development.
What sort of criteria do Fulbright applicants have to meet in order to receive serious consideration?
Well, I would say for the scholar program that Dr. Foley is participating in, academic excellence is certainly a primary criteria, academic and professional record. We also look at the review panels, which are peer panels that are convened by our non-governmental organization partner. They look at the feasibility of the proposed research or lecturing project. And they also look at more personal qualifications, if you will, such as ability to communicate and interest in engaging with societies and peoples overseas.
Do you change as foreign affairs and foreign events warrant the number or the proportion of fellowships given to academicians who want to do research in different parts of the world, or is that set? Is that static?
No, it does reflect broad foreign policy priorities. It also reflects it is a program that supports U.S. bilateral relationships with other countries, so it also reflects the interests of foreign partner governments. But for example, in the period following September 11th, 2001, we increased our emphasis on exchanges with countries with significant Muslim populations in the Muslim world in a number of different regions. So we have been bringing greater numbers of students and scholars from those countries and also supporting more awards for American faculty and students to go to countries in those regions.
Do Fulbright scholars and academicians frequently accept awards that will take them into areas of the world where violence and strife are part of the scene?
The program, the Fulbright program, is active worldwide with about 150 countries. I believe the scholar program, the U.S. scholar program, is currently active with 120 countries. Obviously, we're concerned that we want to make sure that people are as safe as possible on the program. We don't want to send people into any situation that we anticipate is unsafe or where there's civil strife or violence going on. But many of the participants do go to countries in the developing world where living conditions and teaching conditions will not be what they're accustomed to in the United States. So they're making a tremendous contribution to those universities and those societies where they're going. And they also, you know, they need to have those personal qualities of flexibility, you know, willingness to be resourceful in dealing with different kinds of living and teaching and study conditions.
Does it help an applicant if he or she already has had international travel experience?
I think, you know, we're looking for, often people will have an interest in that area and will have pursued opportunities earlier, say in their undergraduate career to study abroad. We're looking for people with a strong interest in international engagement, but also seeking to reach those who haven't previously had so many opportunities. So I wouldn't say that there's a, you know, I think there's a balance in terms of looking at qualifications in terms of prior overseas experience, as long as it appears that the candidate has the interest and the flexibility to teach or to study abroad.
How would you characterize the importance of the Fulbright program in assisting the State Department in fulfilling its agenda of promoting American diplomatic interests around the world?
I think I mentioned a minute ago that we see it as a very important part of our bilateral relationships with other countries. People-to-people connections and exchanges are what Fulbright is all about. Those are very important to the President and to the Secretary of State. It's a way for American scholars and students to contribute to the increase of knowledge, to long-term relationships with other countries. These are direct connections that the scholars and the students are establishing, and you know, in many ways, those are the most compelling for people in the countries where they will be placed and where they will be studying, to hear directly from an American citizen, a scholar, a teacher, about their field, their discipline of expertise, about their experiences in the United States. So it really makes a tremendous long-term contribution. Most of the Fulbright participants keep connections with the country of their assignment after they go home. It's a life-changing experience for many, so it really has a tremendous influence on relationships between peoples and between institutions and countries as well.
And on a personal level, it's also been a career and resume builder for some of the most accomplished Americans ever, wouldn't you say?
That's absolutely right. There are many, we have about 40 Fulbright alumni who have won Nobel Prizes, including American citizens as well as foreign citizens. On the international side, Muhammad Yunus of Bangladesh, who is a recent Nobel winner, established the Grameen Bank for microlending. many Fulbright alumni are Pulitzer winners, MacArthur Foundation Award winners, and many are making very important contributions at universities, NGOs, in business, and as artists, as writers, in many fields.
And we are proud to welcome our own Dr. Sean Foley to the list of Fulbright recipients. And we'd like to thank Marianne Craven, Managing Director for Academic Programs at the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs of the U.S. Department of State, for being with us on the program. We'll turn to Dr. Foley now, but we want to thank you very much for your time and for your insights. Marianne, we appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and it was a real pleasure speaking with you today.
All right. Take care now.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now joining us is Dr. Sean Foley, who is an assistant professor of history here at MTSU, who will be enjoying his third Fulbright fellowship and using it to go to Malaysia for 10 months starting in September and other points in the region as well.
Yeah, no, in fact, thank you very much, A, for having me on the air. It's always a pleasure to see you in person and
Same
to be
interviewed.
As well. This is not the first time I've done this as well. I think this is the third radio show I've done with you.
Yeah.
And again, like the Fulbright, it's a great opportunity to win a Fulbright, but also a wonderful opportunity to be interviewed by you, and an honor. Thank you.
Oh, you are too kind. You're
well,
a scholar and a gentleman.
I do my best. But yeah, absolutely. I'm going to be, it's a wonderful opportunity. As you know, I've just finished a book project on the Arab Gulf states, which are a group of states near Saudi Arabia and its neighbors.
Right.
These states have enormous linkages to Southeast Asia, both commercially as well as culturally, economically, and religiously as well. So that there's sort of there. I've always been thinking about Southeast Asia. I did also my doctoral dissertation on a religious order, a Sufi movement that has a huge following in Southeast Asia. So there's sort of been a natural link. As we were talking before, Malaysia was always something I was aware of. People were aware of Malaysia. Malaysia has a very special place for people in the Middle East as a Muslim society that makes modernity work.
It behooves all of us not to, not just scholars, to stop thinking of the Islamic world as simply Syria and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and those Middle Eastern countries, as well as the Gulf states that you mention in your book, but also Southeast Asian countries like Malaysia and Indonesia.
In fact, as many people know, the largest Muslim state in the world isn't in the Middle East. It is in Indonesia, 120 million. India is also a major country with a very large Muslim population. And in fact, the Indian Ocean is a significant center of Muslim population.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And we also don't want to neglect West Africa with Nigeria, which has a very large Muslim population as well.
Will you be spending time both on the Malay Peninsula and across the South China Sea in the other part of the country?
Most of my time will be spent in Kuala Lumpur. I won't be spending too much time on the other side. That's a good question to ask because they're two very different regions. I also will spend time in Brunei, actually. I've
Yes.
been asked to give a lecture in Brunei in conjunction with the embassy and the University of Darussalam. I've also been asked to go to India as well, so I'll be sort of doing halfway point between the Gulf and Southeast Asia, and I hope to do that later in the year, probably around Christmas time.
Would it be fair to say that the major focus of your search will be Malaysia and that these will be side trips, or do you intend to integrate it all into your...
I certainly have the opportunity to try to integrate it all. Most of my time will be spent in Malaysia, and my actual project, I should probably explain what that is. The actual project is to examine linkages, religious linkages between the Arab Middle East and Southeast Asia. This is building on my already Arabic linguistic skills that I developed in graduate school and over time and my work in the region and on my book, and look at how particularly a journal called Al-Manar, which means lighthouse in the 19th century, influenced the development of modern Islam in Southeast Asia.
It would be interesting to see if that immigration movement still carries characteristics into today, if there are people in other parts of the Islamic world that see Malaysia as a place to go to express 21st century modernity and yet remain true to their faith.
Absolutely. Two ways that you can see that. One is the enormous amount of Arab tourists who go and visit Southeast Asia, particularly Malaysia, on a regular basis. Anyone who watches, say, CNN or anything else in the region will see lots of ads that say Malaysia, truly Asia. And in fact, if you go to the embassy, say, in London, in Trafalgar Square, you'll see that. Absolutely, those linkages are there. And also another linkage, remember, is the Indian Ocean, is the Hajj,
yes,
the annual pilgrimage, where people go from Southeast Asia to the Middle East and back and forth. There are close linkages, intellectual linkages. One of the stories I like to tell, at one point in the not-so-distant past, the vice president of Yemen, one end of the Indian Ocean, shared a father with the foreign minister of Indonesia. Both of them were of Arab ancestry. Their mothers were from their local country. So the Indonesian foreign minister's mother was from Indonesia, Yemen, vice versa. But the fact that one father could have an influence over spaces so large,
yes,
and two very different societies, gives you the idea that these type of relationships that have existed, we've tended to sort of see Southeast Asia as something else or different. Some Americans may have had experience either with themselves or their parents with Vietnam or other things, but it's part of a larger global network in which the Indian Ocean has been important for a very long time.
Are you attempting to learn any of the Malay language, or are you depending upon the languages you already know?
Sure. The first thing is the project is to look at Arabic documents, principally. That's the first thing to do. But sure, absolutely. I will spend part of my time learning Malay, learning the types of, sort of, at the very least, so I can look at texts and have an understanding of them and what I need to do. Happily, English is widely spoken in Southeast Asia, particularly in Malaysia, so I will at least have a good start if I can't find the right Malay word.
What do you know going into the situation, understanding that you're going there to learn in the first place, in your preparation for leaving for Malaysia, about the status of women in that country?
That's a very good question. Malaysia is a country where women are highly educated. There are women who are professionals, including judges. And in fact, questions about women and Islam and women in modernity get answered in very different ways in Malaysia than they do in other parts of the Islamic world. Indeed, issues of questions that we may wonder about women being educated, that's not necessarily an issue in Malaysia. You do see professional women who will wear the veil and other things, but also will wear a veil and a headscarf, but also will wear very distinctly what we would call Western clothing.
Is the Sharia law the ruling rubric, or is the legal system secular, or do they use both?
Like most Muslim societies in the world, we sort of have this assumption that Sharia law is the law of the land in all Muslim societies. That's actually not necessarily the case. In fact, Sharia law is a part of a legal code. That doesn't mean it's not extremely important, but it is part of a legal code. In fact, the legal code of Malaysia reflects the fact that it is a highly diverse society. Not only are there Muslims, but there are Chinese populations of great business and other import. There are Indians or Hindus as well. That doesn't mean that these peoples always get along perfectly. They don't necessarily get along perfectly here as well, as we know. But yes, it's a society, it's a multi-ethnic, multi-diverse society, and its legal code has to reflect that. It's also a society that was part of the English Empire. It's still part of the Commonwealth, so its different traditions reflect those things as well.
How important is oil to this country?
From what I understand, oil is important, but it's much more of a commercial-based society. It's not a major oil exporter in the same way, even as Indonesia was at one time, or other parts of the Gulf. From what I understand, it's important, but not a significant portion. This is a commercial-based society. It's a society that makes, let's be clear, makes things, manufactures things. It's an important trading partner of the United States. I believe it is our 10th largest trading partner, which is significant, and we are Malaysia's largest trading partner. And again, lots of electronics, for instance, will be, say, made in Malaysia as well.
What about rubber and natural resources?
Rubber, natural resources, all other types of things. Again, that's what put them initially economically on the map as well. Palm oil, other types of things. Yes.
I understand, I was looking in preparation for this at the CIA Factbook online, and one of the things it said was that 80% of the population lives in urban areas.
Sure, and that's not, actually that's not unusual at all. In the Middle East, for instance, that's the same thing. We think of places like this as either jungle or desert, and in fact, they're highly, highly urban. It's where economic growth happens, it's where education happens, you know. If you want to make it in many societies in the world, you need to go to an urban center.
Their government in Kuala Lumpur, they have a theocracy, but it's sort of a figurehead theocracy. Like
in a king that's actually an elected king.
Yeah. And then a prime minister,
and a prime minister, and elected in a parliamentary system, based on the West
Great Britain,
but on the Great Britain, as I said, the British Westminster model, and not all the election. It's actually unique. There are very few societies in the world in which an actual king is elected, and in which you don't hold power necessarily for an extended period. You're elected for a period, and then other people serve as well. They represent different communities within the Malaysian Federation, and actually not all members of the Malaysian Federation actually have a king or someone who votes on this panel.
Monsoon season starts in October. Are you ready for monsoon season?
I certainly hope so. It's going to be very, very hot and very, very humid almost the entire time, and it rains a lot.
You've never been through a monsoon before, right?
No, I haven't, but there's the first time. I'd never been through a tornado before coming to Tennessee. I grew up in California where we had earthquakes, but not tornadoes. So if I can adapt to that, I hope to be okay.
And tsunamis?
That too. Look, there are going to be dangers like that almost anywhere part of the world you go to. When I grew up in California with earthquakes that could strike at any moment, or here with tornadoes, as we've seen tragically both in this community in Murfreesboro and other parts of Tennessee.
Or Washington, D.C., which at one time was called the murder capital of the country.
Right, and I did my graduate work. But in terms of natural forces of Mother Nature, wherever you are, there are opportunities for Mother Nature to hit you. And the best thing to do is to learn what the preparations are, and the wealthier society you're in, the more likely it is that they'll have structures and other things. Again, this is a state well attuned to dealing with tornadoes. We have sirens. We have other things that are in place. Even walking into the studio, I saw today, you know, signs what to do for a tornado. And the same thing with tsunamis and other things.
What sorts of preparations are you making on a personal level? I mean, you're an experienced world traveler, so I would expect by now that you would know the drill when it comes to knowing what to pack, how to pack, how to prepare medically, how to prepare logistically, how to prepare your transportation, all of that.
Sure, absolutely. All those things. First, just coming back from getting my shots done, so various different things you have to do. MTSU has a good travel clinic, and they're good people. I encourage anyone traveling abroad to look at getting those shots. Those are very important things to do. So doing things like that, asking questions, learning languages, spending time researching on the internet, talking to friends who I know who have been there. Good example, a colleague, a soon-to-be colleague who teaches at Texas Tech, has his own blog up on the web. Mark McGinley is his name, teaches biology at Texas Tech, has his own blog. So doing research, I came across this blog, and we've been trading emails about such basic things as, so how much money am I going to need when I start out? What's the banking situation like? How much money am I going to need, for instance, to rent an apartment?
Yeah.
You know, sort of what the ballpark. The Fulbright people, there's a Fulbright commission in Southeast Asia, in Malaysia itself, that will help me out with those things. But it's always good to have a good idea ahead of time before going, sort of what those basic things are. You know you're going to run into things that you can't anticipate, but if you can control some of them, like making certain you have your bank accounts are in order, your financial things are in order. I'm actually going up for tenure this year, so I've had to get all my forms ready and make sure all the dates are there. All those types of things. That adds even another level of complexity.
And your wife is going with you.
Yes, thankfully. Yes, that's something I, traveling for 10 months without my wife is something I couldn't imagine. And she's coming. She's someone who's worked with refugees and immigrants. She also was with me when we were in Syria for the second year. She's there. She's quite an experienced foreign traveler. And even better, she picks up foreign languages like right on the spot. She speaks Russian, she speaks Somali, she speaks Arabic, you name it, she's probably had some experience with it.
And she is taking a leave of absence from her job?
That is still being negotiated. So, okay. From what I understand, I think she will be replaced. So 10 months is a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And she works for a small community-based organization that helps resettle refugees in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So from what I understand, I think they're probably going to hire someone else, although I'm sure they'll talk to her, hopefully, when she gets back.
How well educated is the Malaysian population from what you've been able to determine from your preparations?
It is certainly a middle-class, well-educated country that has emphasized education and particularly learning English as part of a way of integrating itself into the global economy. Mm-hmm. They are a country that has looked at what the needs were, what skills did its population set need to do and applied. And it's not just Malaysia. Other parts of Southeast Asia have had very similar ways of pushing their populations mm-hmm. to meet very specific goals of the international economy. What can we do here in Malaysia, not only with our natural resources, palm oil and other things, rubber as well, but what can we develop our human infrastructure? There are portions of Malaysia that look like Silicon Valley that have been able to do that. Mm-hmm. The Straits of Malacca, which is the strait very close to Malaysia, is probably the most important sea lane in the world and has been so forever and ever because it is the gateway between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. And to give you an idea how long this is, if you go to Lisbon, where I was a couple of summers ago, there's a very large map of the Portuguese Empire. Mm-hmm. And one of the places very clearly linked on that empire, early 16th century, that the Portuguese made certain to conquer was Malacca. Because if you're going to bring spices from Asia to India, Asia, India, back to Europe, you better make certain you've got that control of Malacca. It's a very important strategic place, has been, and I suspect will be for a very long time.
Thailand, up until recently, has been a tourism hotspot. Bangkok, a lot of people like to visit Bangkok until recent conflict there. How popular is Malaysia as a tourism destination?
Malaysia is an extremely popular tourism destination. It's a key part of the economy, particularly bringing from those from the Arab world, as I mentioned, from the Middle East. It's mm-hmm. not just people coming over or these part of these going back and forth with the Hajj. It's also Middle Easterners. And again, if you look at McGinley's blog, he's just talked about all the Arabs that he sees mm-hmm. In Southeast Asia, seeing people dressed in very conservative clothing next to people dressed in very progressive or Western clothing, all coming from the Arab world. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Why do we hear so little news from this area of the world in this country? Did we just develop a collective case of Southeast Asia phobia after our traumatic experience in Vietnam? Or
I'm not certain to give you an answer to that. The first thing is, A, it's very far away. I've been working with the Malaysian Fulbright Commission, and 13 hours is a huge difference from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I mean, that means that if I want to communicate or write an email, I have to do it at night our time because it's daytime. Although they're on our same planet, it is as if you're in a completely different place. I don't know. That's something I'll have to give some more thought to. I certainly think distance is one. We've spent a lot of time, intellectually and politically in our time worrying about issues like terrorism in the Middle East. We're fighting two wars, and that justifies a lot of attention in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And to be frank, Southeast Asia doesn't fit into that. It is successful. It's a place that trades well with us. Maybe it's not the end of the world if we ignore it.
And yet it is in the general neighborhood as China, to which we are paying an extraordinary amount of attention.
Yeah, in terms of it's a place that is easy to forget. But and what I meant by sort of the end of the world in that way, I mean, is that if it's producing things, it's doing good things, and we're not aware of it, that isn't the end of the world, but it is absolutely a critical place to understand. It is, as I said, a hub of global commerce. Mm-hmm. It's a place in which we need to, it's a significant hub of global commerce. It's a place that's also important not only for that, it's for Islam, for multiple religious faiths. People come together in that part of the world. Absolutely, we should know more. And in fact, part of my experience going overseas will be I've written regularly for the Tennessean. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm interested in doing, and which the Tennessean has liked me to do, is write columns regularly from Southeast Asia.
And you'll be writing more columns periodically, not specifically on a regular basis, but periodically as per. I wish you would write a blog, but that's okay. The occasional column is good.
Well, a column is good, and I also, my colleague Mark already has a blog.
Competing blogs.
So maybe I'll let him take that. But certainly I'll be doing some of those types of writing, and that's something that I'd like to continue doing. I've done maybe 15, 20 columns over the last 4 or 5 years for the Tennessean. But yeah, it's an idea of doing that. And again, asking some of those questions. yes, I know Americans aren't necessarily as interested in this, and again, the success of it suggests why we've put our attention to other societies, mm-hmm. but it's going to get, I'll have a much better idea once you get there. You learn a lot about yourself when you travel in another culture.
Up until the changeover in administrations, America was thought of there are some countries in which America did not find favor with the local population, shall we say. It was not that they necessarily had something against Americans, but they were very much against the policies of the American government at that time. How do you expect to be received in this multicultural, multi-ethnic environment as an American?
The first thing is, I've never, although we talk about those things, hating Americans, rarely have I ever run into specific hostility as being an American. Many people in the world can separate their views of a government with the actual people themselves. And generally, if you are open and you show respect towards another culture, learning languages always helps, but it's certainly knowing cultural traditions, asking questions, you're generally going to get along okay, and I expect to be fine. And political relations between the countries are, from what I understand, moving reasonably well, and I'm not too worried about that. Although, again, if you learn questions from people, you want to ask some people some questions, and if they tell you some things that aren't necessarily pleasant to hear, you have to sit back and listen. That's part of the experience of learning. That doesn't mean you don't defend your society. That doesn't mean if someone says something completely untrue that you don't say, hey, wait a second, that's not the way it works.
Yes.
But you have to listen first and before you can respond to those types of things. And it's good to have an idea of how other people look at the world. I always encourage my students to travel overseas. And one of the reasons to see how other societies are governed, how they manage, something we can learn to see how we're doing versus somebody else or a new way of doing it.
Right.
Of doing things.
It's all right to ask, there's no such thing as a dumb question. It's all right to be an ignorant American as long if you ask the question in good faith. What isn't proper is to be the ugly American and to barge in assuming that you know all the answers.
Sure, absolutely. And we tend to do that, but we're hardly the only society that does that. Many other societies in the world have faced similar issues and have survived, and I suspect we'll be okay too in the long run.
Dr. Sean Foley, assistant professor in the Department of History, who with his third Fulbright Award will be traveling to Malaysia and other parts of Southeast Asia for 10 months beginning in September. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you very much again.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can catch the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.